are on the rise again. But this generation has found new ways to bring fear to the streets. That's today on Latino USA, the radio journal of news and culture.
Join us for Latino USA tonight at 7:30 on 90.7 FM, KPFK.
KPFK is extending its commitment to community outreach by launching a virtual art gallery to showcase emerging Los Angeles area artists of all visual disciplines. We're seeking a volunteer team of curators and webmasters, as well as submissions from artists to make it all happen. For information on how you can get involved, visit our website at www.kpfk.org or call volunteer coordinator Keola Kama at 818-985-2711, extension 213. That's KPFK's virtual visual art gallery, dedicated to LA's best unknown grassroots creators.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 3rd, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. The United Nations capitulates to Ariel Sharon and Israel. And Jewish and Muslim community leaders in France speak about presidential candidate Jean-Marie Le Pen's surprising popularity. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A report released today by Human Rights Watch does not provide evidence that the Israeli Defense Force massacred hundreds of Palestinians at the Jenin refugee camp. The report does, however, document Israel's willful and unlawful killing of dozens of civilians, the use of Palestinian civilians as human shields, and the use of indiscriminate and excessive force during the operation. They call the abuses extremely serious and, in some cases, war crimes. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Inigo Gilmore is in Jerusalem and reports on the Israeli response.
They're saying that this report ignores the root cause of the incursion, which is that this was a hotbed, they say, of Palestinian militants who are behind at least half of the suicide bombings that have happened during the last 18 months of the Palestinian Intifada. And secondly, they're saying that the numbers of Israeli casualties are in proportion.
Inigo Gilmore, you've just returned from a visit to Jenin. What did you see while you were there?
There is an immense amount of destruction in Jenin. The Human Rights Watch report estimated that about 140 houses were leveled in Jenin, leaving several hundred people homeless. There have been claims that some of these buildings were destroyed at the end of the operation, almost like a collective punishment. The Human Rights Watch report does say that they found evidence of indiscriminate and disproportionate use of force by the Israeli army. What you're seeing on the ground there would seem to bear that out. There is a huge level of destruction in the camp. The people on the ground there are in a very desperate situation. They need support, first of all, to rebuild their homes, but also more immediately just to keep them alive.
That's Free Speech Radio News correspondent Inigo Gilmore in Jerusalem. A last-ditch attempt to keep Mexican trucks from rolling across the U.S. border has failed. An appeals court denied an emergency request by a coalition of groups who say the trucks will further pollute the air and cost U.S. jobs. Chris Bruni has more from San Francisco.
A coalition of environmental, consumer, and labor organizations took their case against the Department of Transportation to court on Wednesday. They want to stop the government from implementing regulations for the operation of Mexican trucks in the U.S. The regs are expected to be signed by President Bush today. The rules outline safety and operational requirements for the trucks, but the plaintiffs say that they don't deal with air emissions, and emissions tests in Mexico are lax. The plan to allow the trucks into the United States is a component of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. Supporters of lifting the moratorium accuse opponents of trying to stifle trade between the two nations. The plaintiffs say they are working to get another court date before the trucks are due to come in as early as next month. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Chris Bruni in San Francisco.
Three Muslim groups, including the International Institute of Islamic Thought, and 10 American citizens were in court today in Alexandria, Virginia, to ask a judge to reveal secret evidence used to justify a raid on them in March. Gareth Schweitzer has more.
The raided individuals and organizations are asking the courts to force the federal government to return their property and say publicly why they were raided. Prosecutors claim that no documents were seized beyond the warrant's scope. Yesterday's motion, however, states that the organizations have been unable to operate as everything from computers to academic records were seized. Lawyers for the American Civil Liberties Union have said that the government should provide at least a limited version of the sealed affidavits that contain the secret evidence that prosecutors say justified the raids. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
Documents obtained by the National Security Archive show Congressman Dennis Hastert sent a cable in 1997 to the U.S. Ambassador to Colombia, lamenting past Congresses that used human rights as an excuse to aid the left in other countries. Jenna Stevenson reports from Washington.
Hastert went on to vow in the cable that he was committed to correcting that situation and encouraged the Colombian military to bypass the Clinton White House and deal directly with Congress. Hastert, now Speaker of the House, has been highly involved in trying to reform Plan Colombia to ease restrictions on where aid money goes. Jason Hagan of the Washington Office on Latin America found the new revelations disturbing in light of the continued rights abuses of the Colombia military.
This is an alarming revelation, primarily because Hastert is one of the prime movers right now on changing the mission in Colombia in the light of evidence that suggested that there have not been any real positive gestures taken by the Colombian military.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Jenna Stevenson.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The UN Security Council remains deadlocked today over Israel's rejection of a fact-finding mission to the Jenin refugee camp, as Palestinians reject a U.S.-backed proposal for an international peace conference on the Middle East. Susan Wood reports from the United Nations.
The UN Security Council resumed closed consultations today on a response to Secretary General Kofi Annan's decision to cancel a fact-finding mission into Israel's devastating assault on the Jenin refugee camp. After initially agreeing to the mission, Israel delayed it four times, finally saying the team could not travel to Jenin. Meanwhile, Palestinians reacted coolly today to a U.S. proposal coming out of yesterday's meetings in Washington between Annan and U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. Powell says the administration wants an international peace conference on the Middle East that he says would clear the way forward to a Palestinian state. But Palestinian Cabinet Minister Nabil Shat said Palestinians would not back the conference plan until Israel leaves land seized during the uprising and international observers are in the Palestinian territories. Israel has repeatedly rejected such international monitoring. At the UN, meanwhile, Syria and Tunisia have given up their attempt to have the deadlocked Security Council adopt a resolution critical of Israel and are talking instead of reconvening an emergency General Assembly session on the Middle East. The U.S., Israel's closest ally, has no veto power in the Assembly, whose 189 members overwhelmingly back the Palestinians. But unlike the 15-member Council, the Assembly has no power to enforce its decisions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
We go now to Phyllis Bennis, who is a fellow for the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. She's been studying the relationship between Israel and the United Nations. Phyllis, is the UN capitulation to Israel and Sharon a green light for further Israeli state violence?
Unfortunately, it looks to be exactly that. The U.S. clearly bears major complicity in this. There was an apparent quid pro quo between the U.S. and Israel, in which Israel agreed to the compromise on the solution to the crisis at the compound in Ramallah, where Yasser Arafat had been held. The Israelis agreed to let him go in return for, it appears, agreement from the U.S. that it would back Israel in its rejectionism of the team being sent to Jenin. I think it's that U.S. role that makes this crisis so significant.
Now, the U.S. is putting out there that they are organizing this peace summit for the summer. How does this play into the fact that the U.N. fact-finding team is not going to Jenin?
The key thing is that we have to really watch what the U.S. has in mind when it talks about an international conference. My guess is that this will be much more on the level of the kind of conference we saw in Madrid in 1991, where an international event looking very much like a conference, took place, but which was not empowered to actually have the serious diplomacy go forward at that time. Instead, the Madrid conference served as an opening gambit to begin separate bilateral sessions between Israel and each of the Arab parties separately, in which, of course, Israel has much more power than it would in the context of an international conference. A real international conference under the auspices of the Security Council of the United Nations, along with all of the parties, including Israel, the PLO/PA, all of the Arab states, all of the relevant parties, is exactly what the international community has been demanding for many, many years. The U.S. and Israel have refused that. I see no indication that they have now changed their minds.
So what exactly then is the consequence, if any, for Israel in the aftermath of Jenin now that the fact-finding team won't be going? And what power, if any, does the United Nations have to investigate further crimes?
Well, of course, there are precedents in the United Nations of countries refusing to accept fact-finding teams of various sorts, either because of composition or for other reasons. The most familiar, I think, is the precedent of Iraq, where the Iraqi regime, after the UNSCOM sectors pulled out of their own volition in advance of the U.S. bombing in December of 1998, Iraq refused to allow them to go back. There's another precedent in Congo when Laurent Kabila refused to accept a fact-finding team because its chairman, the Chilean human rights activist Roberto Garatón, had once written an earlier critical report. In both of those cases, the U.N. played a very different role than we see currently in regard to the team in Jenin. In Iraq in particular, we see this, again, by the United States being used as a justification for imposing sanctions, enforcement, military enforcement of the so-called no-fly zones, etc. The difference is here, Israel is being privileged by its backing by the United States, which prevented, at least so far, a Security Council resolution from going through that would use part of the UN Charter that talks about sanctions and talks about the legality of using force to reverse a threat to international peace and security. The U.S. has apparently told the Israelis it would not allow such a resolution to go through, and it is prepared to use its veto.
Phyllis Bennis, a fellow for the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Connecticut Governor John Rowland has signed into law a measure that gives the state the toughest clean air standards in the country. The law follows 5 years of intensive lobbying by environmentalists and community activists. Ubong Adoma reports from Hartford.
Connecticut Governor John Rowland signed the clean air measure into law just as the American Lung Association was releasing its annual report on air pollution in the United States. According to that report, the air pollution over most of Connecticut is bad. Connecticut's new law is aimed at cleaning up the so-called Sooty Six, Connecticut's oldest and dirtiest fossil fuel-burning electric power plants. Under the law, the operators of the power plants in Bridgeport, Middletown, Milford, Montville, New Haven, and Norwalk will have to meet strict sulfur dioxide emission standards by January 1, 2005. It also bans a practice known as pollution credit trading, in which owners of older plants are allowed to swap emission credits with newer plants that are often out of state. The law is the result of a compromise that followed Governor John Rowland's veto of a similar measure last year. The governor says that bill did not guarantee Connecticut's power supply. He says those concerns have now been met.
It was a compromise that was negotiated and had input from our DEP commissioner and folks at the Department of Public Utility Control. And I think it's a very fair compromise. It's still the toughest standards in the country that are in regulation and in statute.
Democrats have blamed pressure from the Bush administration and the energy industry for the governor's veto of last year's bill. State Representative Chris Caruso of Bridgeport, one of the sponsors of the measure, says he believes the governor changed his mind this year because it's an election year.
I want to believe that the governor is looking at an election and saying to himself, is he going to be a true environmental governor or is he going to be one that vetoes environmental legislation one time after the other?
Community activists and environmentalists who had worked on the measure for the past 5 years say they are happy it's now become law. Brooke Sutter, Connecticut Director for the National Organization Clean Water Action and an organizer with the Connecticut Coalition for Clean Air, says the strict standards will remove nearly 9,000 tons of sulfur dioxide a year. She says the law repudiates the Bush administration's environmental policy of pollution credit trading.
Sulfur dioxide has local health impacts, and for that pollutant, it's inappropriate to use pollution credit trading. This is an issue that is being worked on nationally as well as in many other states in the country, and this state being the first to make sure that the local health impacts are taken into consideration is a very great importance for the environment and public health.
Owners of the power plant still maintain that the law will adversely affect the state's electricity supply. NRG, the Minnesota-based energy company that owns a number of the plants, says it is reviewing its Connecticut business. In a written statement, the company says it believes the law will result in a significant increase to its production costs and do little to improve air quality. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ebong Udama in Hartford.
Predatory lending, the imposition of unfair and abusive loan terms on borrowers, has drawn increasing fire from community activists and legislators in recent years. Consumer advocates charge that predatory lenders, like Household Finance, use aggressive sales tactics and deception to trap borrowers, who most commonly live in poor or minority communities, into complex financing schemes that price gouge clients, undercut their credit ratings, ratchet up home foreclosures, and threaten the financial stability of whole communities. Chris Giovannis of Chicago Indie Media reports.
Household Finance Corporation sent Chicago resident Merlin Bell, who works as a teacher's aide, an unsolicited check for $10,000, what is known as a live check in loan parlance, at roughly the same time her retired husband went into the hospital for triple bypass surgery. With medical and other bills mounting, Merlin cashed the check. She knew the check was a loan, and Household contacted her about repayment terms. But Merlin charges that she was misled about the terms of the loan, tricked into a refinancing scheme that bound her to an exorbitantly expensive financing arrangement that has threatened her financial security, and that Household Finance thwarted her efforts to negotiate a fair loan rate. Merlin Bell.
I really wasn't told at that point how much the interest was on that particular check, because they was talking about refinancing and paying off other debts that I had, and that they would, you know, pay that loan off, the check for the $10,000. Every month I get my statement, I see the principal remains the same. Everything is being eaten up by interest rates. I was just flabbergasted about that, and so I wanted help. I tried to work with them, try to get some relief, but I couldn't get anything, just trying to get me drawn in, taxed in more. I even went to my bank trying to get refinanced. My debt ratio was too high. I shared this with them. Everything that I went through, I shared it with them, hoping that I could get some relief. Even with the insurance, I told them I didn't want it. I felt that was a ripoff. They wouldn't give me any relief until the lawyer sent a letter to them. Then they refunded the insurance check. But everything I had to get help from the outside before I can get help from them through Household Finance.
On Thursday, Merlin, her husband James, and another Chicagoan filed a class action lawsuit charging parent company Household International and several subsidiaries with sweeping consumer fraud. The suit charges Household tricks borrowers into refinancing schemes that bind them to the lender for many years and prevents them from refinancing at more reasonable market rates. Their lawsuit asked the court to declare Household's practices illegal, to order Household to immediately cease and desist from these practices, and to order Household to reimburse money gained through these financing schemes. ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, is supporting the plaintiffs in their efforts to win relief from Household's practices. Denise Dixon, president of Chicago ACORN.
We know in the last 3 years that Household Finance has gotten $45 billion in monies that they should not have, because this money was gotten through predatory lending, it was gotten through fees, it was gotten through interest payments that are way above and beyond what they should have gotten in the first place. We estimate 150,000 people nationwide have been hurt by household finances practices, at least 3,000 in the state of Illinois. We are here to say that we will no longer allow household finance to take advantage of people, to charge them monies that they should not have. Household owes us $45 billion and we want it. Whatever folks have paid in fees and interest, I want them to get it back, every penny of it.
The Bells say Household told them that consolidating their outstanding debts would save them money when it would not, and did not tell them the interest rate on the new loan was higher than the average interest rate on their existing debt. The Bells also say Household misled them about terms of loan insurance and did not disclose information about a complex series of fees and prepayment penalties that seriously impaired the Bells' ability to refinance. In a press statement, Household responded by charging Acorn with launching baseless accusations and instigating groundless legal action. Household has been battered by a number of unfavorable court rulings in recent months, including a $12 million settlement this January in California for overcharging thousands of customers, and an April decision that potentially exposes Household and H&R Block to billions of dollars in damages for price gouging customers with refund anticipation loans at interest rates that can exceed 100%. This is Chris Giovannis of Chicago Indie Media for Free Speech Radio News.
The Bush administration says it's committed to funding higher education, but congressional Democrats counter that a new plan would leave hundreds of thousands of college students with less federal aid. At the state level, public colleges and universities are always hit hard during recessions, and at least 10 states are considering double-digit cuts in funding for higher education this year. For students, all of this means more debt at the end of college, or maybe not continuing their education beyond high school at all. From Boulder, Colorado, Nell Geiser reports.
John Diaz is a junior at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Along with other students waiting outside the financial aid office this morning, he says he wouldn't be able to attend college without help from the federal and state government.
I receive Pell Grants and student loans. Without it, I definitely wouldn't be going to school, and I'd be stuck with some low-paying job, getting nowhere.
While more students are going on to college than ever before, tuition remains prohibitive for many. Yesterday, congressional Democrats held a press conference criticizing the Bush administration's student financial aid plan. They say it would serve 375,000 fewer low-income students. The administration recently increased the federal Pell Grant to a maximum of $4,000, but other programs have not seen similar increases, and the Pell Grants may soon decrease by an average of $100 under Bush's new plan. The plan was part of an anti-terrorism bill, but it met significant opposition in Congress and is now nearly dead. White House representatives and some Republican members of Congress say that the critique offered by the Democrats is disingenuous and simply an attempt to build a campaign platform on higher education funding. Department of Education officials and several Republican congressmen were not available for comment. According to an independent report examining the affordability of higher education, state and federal aid has not kept up with increases in tuition over the past 20 years. Losing Ground, a national status report on the affordability of American higher education, was released yesterday by the National Center for Public Policy and American Higher Education. Patrick Kalan is president of the California-based think tank. He says the government needs to make a stronger commitment to financial aid at all levels.
Our advice would be to both the state and the federal government that more investment in need-based financial aid, unless you want to squeeze people out who may be talented and motivated to go to college, unless you want money to be a major factor, that we need to make a larger national and state investment in financial aid.
Back at the University of Colorado, the financial aid office is busy. The federal government provides students on this campus with $6 million in grants and work-study money.
I think as a community, we want lower-income students to have the opportunity to attend school.
Karen Johnson is the director of financial aid at CU Boulder.
And as costs have risen, the grant funds have not risen in sync. It's really critical that students have an opportunity to attend college, and the only way that that population is going to be able to attend school is to receive grant funds, and the federal government should be taking the lead.
For families of low-income students, college tuition represents a larger percentage of family income than it did 20 years ago. Many students look to loans for help, and the average cumulative debt by the end of college is around $13,000, up from $7,600 in 1989. Jenny Lloyd is a peer advisor at the CU Financial Aid Office and helps students navigate grants, loans, and work study.
At CU, there's a lot of kids that want to come here from out of state, especially that whose parents maybe make like $50,000 a year, but they don't have $30,000 a year to send them to CU, and yet all we can give them is like another loan for their parents to take out. I think that's the most frustrating thing, especially this time of year when all these freshmen like really want to come to CU, but they have to choose to go to a private school instead because they can afford to give them, grants and scholarships that we just can't give them.
A college education is also becoming less available to students of color. Rollbacks of affirmative action around the country, institutional racism on campuses, and less federal aid is causing fewer youth of color to see college as an option. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Geiser in Boulder, Colorado.
More anti-Semitic attacks across Europe today. Vandals knocked down 18 of the 20 memorial stones at the Dachau concentration camp near Munich. Police also found several empty beer bottles. And at a Jewish cemetery in Landsberg am Lech, about 30 miles west of Munich, two gravestones were toppled and another damaged. Police said they believe the vandalism was carried out by the same group of suspected far-right extremists. Meantime in France, far-right presidential candidate Jean-Marie Le Pen today told reporters he would not be surprised if he won Sunday's election. Le Pen also said he looked forward to next month's parliamentary elections, predicting that his showing this weekend would serve as a springboard for National Front candidates across France. Reporter Khalid Sid Mohan spoke to Jewish and Muslim community leaders in France about Le Pen's surprising popularity. He files this report.
Like many of the cafes in the northern neighborhoods of Paris, the owner as well as the customers are of Arab descent. The presence of Jean-Marie Le Pen, the extreme right-wing candidate in the second round of the French presidential elections this Sunday, threatens the Arab and African immigrants community. Sofiane, a 14-year-old son of a Tunisian immigrant, was scared on Wednesday as thousands gathered to hear Le Pen.
Today I can see them in broad daylight because they go out for their 1st of May demonstration. But the other days, we cannot know who they are. We cannot know if they are racist or not. We cannot know what they think when watching us. We cannot know what's inside of them. So I came here to figure out what they look like, to see the hate they express.
Are you scared?
No, I'm not scared. We have to say no to fear.
The demonstrations of the 1st of May were expected to bring about tensions and violence, but they took place in a peaceful atmosphere among the both extreme right-wing followers and the anti-Le Pen demonstrators. Although different ethnic groups do not live apart in France as they often do in the United States, the two communities, the Jewish and Muslims, have for the first time challenged the candidates on the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Frank is Jewish. He's the manager of a pizzeria in Paris.
Faut pas oublier que Jospin, on le sait, il est ami d'Israël, mais ceux qui l'entourent.
We mustn't forget that Socialist Prime Minister Lionel Jospin is a friend of Israel, but the people around him are enemies of Israel. The French government, through its Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hubert Védrine, was biased in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, so the French Jewish community has punished the Socialist Party. In the meantime, the anti-Jewish demonstrations, as well as the burnt down of synagogues, have influenced people in voting for Le Pen.
After Le Pen won entry into the finals of France's presidential election, the leader of country's largest Jewish organization told Israel Haaretz newspaper, Le Pen's surprise victory should demonstrate to Arabs to the need to keep quiet. Emmanuel Weintraub is an executive member of the CRIF, the umbrella organization of the Jewish community in France.
Most of them wouldn't have voted for people who take anti-Jewish positions, or who are systematically anti-Israeli or something like that.
The Arab community is less structured and less politicized. If it is strongly affected by the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it has not managed to canalize its members towards the pro-Palestinian candidates. The shock provoked by Jean-Marie Le Pen's result on the first round of the elections might push the North African community to go massively to the polling stations and vote against the extreme right-wing candidate. In the first round, the Arab community featured the lowest voter turnout in the country. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Khaled Sid Mohand in Paris.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WBAI.